Do we know the radical Martin Luther King Jr.? When he died, he was mostly despised. 2 years before King was murdered, as he headed to northern cities to address poverty, slums, housing segregation, and bank lending discrimination, the Gallup poll found that 63% of Americans had an unfavorable view of King. The FBI at the time called him, Dr. King, the most dangerous man in America, and regularly surveilled him. Because of his contacts with known terrorists of his day, such as Nelson Mandela, under our current policies of the National Security Administration and Obama administration, King would have been subject to detention without trial and assassination by executive decree. Yet today, a recent Gallup poll discovered that 94% of Americans view King in a positive light. But do we know him? It is easy to sanitize King in order to evade his challenge to us. Each time a black community riots, social media and the national media erupt, shaming the rioters with King's call to nonviolence. Yet do they know that King said, "The riot is the language of the unheard." King did believe that violence was both immoral and impractical. And yet, he never discounted the reasons for the rage at the root of riots. He said, "I contend this cry of black power is at bottom a reaction to the reluctance of white power to make the kind of changes necessary." King would reel at his words being used to silence dissent. And which is the most commonly known of King's speeches? The "I Have a Dream" speech, right? We remember King the dreamer, but rarely do we remember King the critic, the rabble-rouser. What are the most remembered lines from that speech? You all probably know it. "I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character." Little wonder why this is the line we remember. This line is regularly lifted from its context to promote colorblindness. Not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. To promote the potential for reverse racism, to promote the belief that because slavery ended and the civil rights era happened and Obama is president, that we now live in a post-racial society and need not talk anymore about white privilege or the need for affirmative action or even reparations. King would be horrified at this use of his words. He said, "White people's belief in the fairness of America is a fantasy of self-deception and comfortable vanity." He declared then and would certainly declare now that his dream is not yet real, not even close. Yes, race is culturally constructed, and that's the problem. We do not yet live in a time where skin color does not matter. We have not yet even repaired the damage done. We have not accounted for the many privileges given to generations and generations of white Americans and the many burdens and roadblocks set before people of color. Slavery is only 2 to 3 generations in the past. And even after slavery ended, the Jim Crow laws that followed relegated black people to second-class citizenship for nearly a century. This photo is from 25 years after the end of slavery, the quote, end of slavery. These black boys are all in a forced labor camp, working for free, often for 6 days a week. Many were arrested and convicted for loitering or vagrancy or speaking loudly to a white woman. While people seen as white were given low-interest loans or land grants or free education, those privileges inevitably trickling down as greater opportunities for their children, the grandchildren and great-grandchildren of slaves were vulnerable to the trickle-down of poverty, of trauma. This can be said of many of the people of color in our country. Think of Native Americans. Who would honestly think that their high rates of alcoholism and suicide are solely due to their own supposed flaws and not the inheritance of oppression? And I don't want to highlight only the ways people of color have struggled. They have certainly persevered. Under unimaginable circumstances, they have garnered strength of character, courage, deep resilience. Mexican and Latin American people, for example, are some of the most hardworking people I have known. If only our country did not require their sacrifice. The radical king believed that in order for there to be true racial and economic justice, there must be, quote, a radical redistribution of political and economic power. Yes, King was a socialist. How much of us would be comfortable with redistribution? I hear he was also a libertarian. People are complex. Georgetown University was in the news last year for taking steps to atone for its part in slavery. In 1838, to save itself from going under, Georgetown sold 272 slaves, human bodies, worth about $3.3 million in today's dollars. And last year, Georgetown announced it would atone by offering a formal apology, creating an institute for the study of slavery, erecting a public memorial, and offering preferential admission to the descendants of those 272 slaves. Critics say this is a step in the right direction, but does not really qualify as reparations. Memorials and apologies only do so much. Even giving preferential treatment to slaves' descendants in the application process relies on those young people's ability to achieve a certain degree of academic success among difficult circumstances, to know that they were descendants of Georgetown slaves, and to be able to afford college. Georgetown has not said that they would give scholarships. Reparations become an even more complicated issue when we realize our country continues to profit off of people of color. That may sound extreme, but the prison industrial complex is a web of government and for-profit entities that profit, literally profit off of prisoners, 70% of whom are people of color, most arrested for petty drug crimes, usually marijuana. Many companies whose products we use daily have found that prison labor can be as profitable as third world labor, or more. IBM, Motorola, Texas Instruments, Honeywell, Microsoft, Boeing, Revlon, Nordstrom's, Chevron, Victoria's Secret, and more use cheap prison labor. King saw all of this on its way. He confided in his friend Harry Belafonte, saying, "You know, we fought long and hard for integration, but I tell you, Harry, I've come on a realization that really troubles me. I've come to the realization that I think we may be integrating into a burning house." Rampant poverty and the war in Vietnam really galvanized this critique of King. He began speaking about the three evils of society, not only racism, but also materialism and militarism. King was radical because he saw to the root of problems. The word radical means root. So the radical king called for a revolution of values from a thing-oriented society to a person-oriented society, as James read before. He came out against the Vietnam War when it was incredibly unpopular to do so, even among black leaders. Before he died, he was planning the Poor People's Campaign, a mass march and occupation of D.C. until the U.S. government granted poor people of diverse backgrounds an economic bill of rights. The king that we narrow down usually to concerns about race was also the king concerned with war, with exploitation, with poverty in any race. He told this story of talking with the white wardens when he was in jail in Birmingham. The second or third day, we got down to talking about where they lived, the white wardens, and how much they were earning. And when those brothers told me how much they were earning, I said, "Now you know what? You ought to be marching with us. You're just as poor as Negroes." And I said, "You are put in the position of supporting your oppressor because through prejudice and blindness, you fail to see that the same forces that oppress Negroes in American society oppress poor white people. And all you are living on is the satisfaction of your skin being white, and the drum major instinct of thinking that you are somebody big because you are white. And you're so poor you can't send your children to school. You ought to be out here marching with every one of us when we have a march." King's vision of the beloved community was truly different than the status quo, both then and now. The black author Cornel West says that King would in fact be dismayed by much of Obama's presidency. West says, "The dream of the radical King for the first black president surely was not a Wall Street presidency, a drone presidency, and surveillance presidency. The morning of the day when King was killed, he had called his church to give them the title of his sermon planned for that Sunday. The title was, 'Why America May Go to Hell.' 2 months earlier, he had preached about how America would go to hell if it did not use its vast wealth to create justice and peace instead of poverty and violence. But the way King was truly radical was in his spirituality. The deep wells of his faith gave him the power to be unpopular, to skirt risk, to face death at every turn. His faith was in radical love. Not passive love, but active, courageous love. In my office, I have this photograph from the protests and the water hoses, and those water hoses will do significant damage to bodies. And in my office next to this photo, it says, courage. Not what we typically think of courage, but this is the courage of nonviolent love. Cornel West says, King understood radical love as a form of death, a relentless self-examination in which a fearful, hateful, egoistic self dies daily to be reborn into a courageous, loving, and sacrificing